Is the Chicken Big Mac still a Big Mac? It's got two chicken patties, the pickles, the lettuce, ooh, the cheese, the sesame seed bun, and it's got the sauce. It's not a Big Mac. Get it while you can. And participate in McDonald's for a limited time.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
All right, guys. Welcome back.
Yeah.
We got a special episode. We got the gentleman of Melanin Money. Thank you, brothers, man. George and Carter. We actually connected with you guys in an InvestFest. You hosted a dinner for us.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate that.
Yeah.
And just been doing your thing, you know, seeing clips online, going crazy for a while now. And I know we both have different backgrounds in finance. Yeah. From the CPA side and from the financial advisor side. So,
which is dope. We don't really see that.
Not for sure.
Which is really dope.
So that's an interesting dynamic as far as financial advisor, CPA kind of go hand in hand in corporate world. The combination is made online.
Yeah.
On the online side. So yeah, it's gonna be a dope conversation. Yeah. But first and foremost, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Happy to be here, man.
Yeah. Excited. We appreciate the award.
Yeah, I mean, that was earned and not given.
Well, everything is earned.
Yeah. Pun intended. Yeah. Pun intended.
But yeah, we were in Chicago at our brother Ross Mag's joint. And I told y'all, I think I told you, Carter, I was like, look, I'm so proud of y'all because obviously people see us together all the time and it's two black men, but two brothers doing it together.
Yeah.
So when I saw y'all doing it, I'm like, don't stop.
Yeah.
No matter what, don't stop.
Yeah for sure. And it's not like... And I asked, so I brought this up to you at the InvestFest. Then I'm like, how do y'all stay so connected through the highs and lows? People think that partnerships is always easy from the outside.
Yeah.
But we just admire what y'all were doing. So it was like, we gonna keep going.
Sure. So how did this come together? Like, how did you guys connect? Like, what's the backstory of you guys coming together, work together?
Yeah. So we went to a conference in 2019. It was a financial advisor conference, and you know how the industry is, right? So it wasn't many of us in the room. So kind of stuck out like sore thumbs. We had broke for lunch, walked to lunch. I was like, oh, it's a black dude, you know, kind of swaggy. I was like, let's rap, let's connect. And we got to talking and realized that we had a lot of similarities in what we was doing. At the time, because you started out like as a financial advisor who just happened to be a CPA as well.
Yeah.
So we realized we were running our businesses in the same way, targeting entrepreneurs. And then we just decided every other Monday for 2 years, it was like, let's just mastermind. Let's just get on the call. What's working in your business? What's working in my business? We were just idea sharing. We did that for 2 years and still liked each other afterwards. So it was just like, yo, maybe we should.
He showed up every Monday for 2 years. Like we didn't miss any meetings. And that was my first idea. Like, you know, entrepreneurship could be lonely.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And we were just able to rap. And then the thing I loved the most about it was any accomplishments I told him, it didn't. It motivated him. It didn't intimidate him. Cause you know, like I'm from the South Side of Chicago. So like I would tell somebody my wins and it would make them feel away. So I had a safe space where I can talk about my wins and things I was going through. And so we did that for 2 years. And then after that, it was like, man, like we could probably kind of bring this thing together.
Yeah.
And then it was kind of a wrap from there.
What company did y'all work for?
So I originally started out with Mass Mutual when I first started.
Okay.
And then I launched my own firm probably like 2.5 years after being in the industry, just because I wanted to, you know, do it my own way, whether it was ignorance or genius, I don't know yet. We're still figuring
to be determined.
Yeah. And so we had our own firms at that point, right? He was doing his own thing, I was doing my own thing. And after the 2 years, we were like, all right, well, let's come together, at least in some, we don't want to go all in just yet. And that's when we launched the podcast, right? So it's like, we can launch the media, like do that for another, being how long at the time, we did that for another 2 years. And then we just realized that we were just better together. Right, and that's when eventually we just came together completely, combined our businesses, merged, all that jazz.
It's interesting. Like, I actually watched the process of him starting his career in financial advisor, and I remember him locking himself in the room, studying, not being able to go out. I'm like, damn, this dude is really like focused.
Yeah.
So y'all both did that What made you say, like, all right, I'm going to be a CPA too? I mean, that in itself is like, when I talk to our CPA, I'm like, damn, she knows a lot.
Yeah.
How did you even get interested in doing both?
Yeah, so I started out as a CPA first, actually. So okay. I worked at KPMG, Big Four, you know, working 12 hours a day, like ridiculous. And my clients will always... So when I started my own business, my client, you know, I would do their tax advisory, tax planning, but they would always ask me financial stuff as well. Mm-hmm. And before I met him, I didn't have any financial advisor I can go to, like a George or like a Rashad, to like help my clients with investing. So I decided to study again to get my financial advisor license so that I can have the accounting piece handled and then the financial advising piece handled as well. And so I studied for both and I got both licenses. And studying for CPA was really hard. Being a financial advisor was hard as well, but I think it really helped me because now that I understand the full scheme of things, even when he's advising our clients, I can give him some advice too. So
yeah, okay. I got a bridge to say.
Yeah.
So you still practice?
Yeah.
So how is that from like on the financial planning side?
Yeah.
Your securities license?
Yep.
So how is that with like social media? Because I know when I was doing it, it was a lot of... compliance?
Yeah.
Fortunately, like when I first, like early on, when I became an RIA, a registered investment advisory firm, I got like audited early, right? Because I was on social media even at that time. But it was the best thing that could happen to me because I had a compliance consultant to help me understand like what you can say, how can you say it? How do things have to be documented so that you have a clear delineation between your firm and the education piece, right? Because I was on the verge too. Like as we started, like the online thing started taking off. I'm just like, do I still want to have these credentials? Because from a compliance standpoint, I don't want any issues. But I was able to find a way to still do it, as long as everything were documented. We have a form called ADV. I'm pretty sure you're familiar with it. We just had to document things really, really well and have a separation between the education and the advisory piece.
Yeah. I think something's really important because, you know, we both thought about like. Because in today's day and age, it's all about education. That's all the people are teaching. There's very few people that are still doing implementation. And so, we kind of had that thought, like, do we just want to teach? But I really appreciate the fact that we stayed in it because now we can educate our clients, but we can actually like, do the work. Because I feel like there's very few people in this day and age is actually doing the work on the back end of the education that they're giving as well.
So when y'all starting at the process of business formation, what is the mission statement, right? Are you aligned on it or do you have different visions for it?
Yeah.
And we said, all right, this is what we're selling at.
Yeah.
How did that process go about?
Yeah, so I had the mission originally, but even before we came together, I knew that I wanted to help close the wealth gap by $100 billion. And the way that I felt like that was going to be possible was by helping 100,000 people of color achieve their first $1 million in net worth. And I knew that wasn't necessarily going to mean that we were going to have 100,000 clients, right? I knew that we were going to have scalable ways to impact people, right? And so when we had that mission, I told him about it and he was just like, yo, that's something that's way bigger than us, something we can do for the foreseeable future. And that's our North Star as a company, right? So as a matter of fact, the reason why we do the awards show is we want to celebrate people as they're achieving their different net worth milestones, right? So first 100K in net worth, half a million, a million, et cetera. In the first 5 months of the year, our clients improved their collective net worth by $100 million, right? And we were able to verify that because we have this financial planning software that everybody syncs up their accounts and they have to actually submit and show the timestamp of what their net worth was at this point versus what it was when they submitted for the award. So now we're able to kind of gamify wealth building. Because when I first had that idea, people were like, people are not going to tell you how much.
Yeah, I thought you were crazy, bro.
Yeah.
I thought you were crazy.
People are not going to tell you what their net worth is, but... Yeah. When people want to be a part of the mission, they want to be a part of that number. And so that has been really instrumental with the movement.
Were people transparent right away? That is an issue, right?
Yeah. Like,
people like they want you to do well.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, you start showing them and it's like, it can get uncomfortable. So like right away, people were like, let me upload this.
Yeah, because when we told them they were receiving an award for it,
right.
That's when the adoption happened.
Gotcha.
Because people would do more for recognition than they will for money. Right. So when people are like, oh, if you submit, we're going to reward you, you know, in front of your peers. Like, oh, OK, I want my award. Like people were like when we had our last award show, people were like hitting up our team like, I missed the deadline. Can I still upload my stuff so I can get awarded? So we realized that, like, again, especially our culture, we want to be recognized more than anything. Some people haven't been celebrated since graduating high school to graduating college. Mm-hmm. So once they found out they were going to be recognized on stage for their wealth building milestones, dude, they adopted it really fast.
Yeah. And some of our older clients, they might have like, what's this thing? Like they might have some reservations about it, but by and large, most people, they're pretty much with it.
So Carter, what's some tax saving strategies as far as on the, I see you online a lot, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of different information that you provide.
Yeah.
So what is some major tax saving strategies that people can actually implement?
Yeah, so I think one of the easiest things that people can do is, like, don't let your job trick you into thinking that they're the only person that can pay you, right? Whatever you're doing from 9 to 5, somebody else will pay you to do from 5 to 9, right? So the reason I say that is because once you start a business, you are able to take advantage of the tax code. The IRS created the tax code to benefit entrepreneurs and investors, not W-2 employees. So if you can start a business, then you can start turning your personal expenses into business expenses. So for example, if you start a business, use your cell phone, that personal expense is now a business expense. You can write off a portion of your cell phone bill on your taxes every single month. So once you start the business, you start looking around and a lot of your personal expenses can be written off in your business. And that's one of the easier ways to lower your taxable income. And if your business was to, you know, lose money in the first year, the loss that you take from that you're taking your business can also be subtracted from your W-2 income. So I think the easiest way for people to start out by saving on taxes is to start a business or become a real estate investor, because that's who the tax code is made for. And then once you go from there, there's a whole bunch of other strategies that we can unlock, writing off your car, writing off your rent, taking advantage of real estate. But I think starting a business is the easiest way for people to start leveraging the tax code in their favor.
That's pretty good, because I was watching your Instagram. I'm like, damn, that sounds just like a clip I seen.
Yeah. I've heard since a couple times, brother. Yeah.
George, I'm coming to you, man, because it's an interesting time. And I've had this conversation a few occasions. I know more millionaires than I've ever known before, mm-hmm. right? As you start to get in some rooms, your network, obviously your net worth grows. At this level, as you're creating more millionaires, mm-hmm. right? That's the goal. That's the mission statement. Yeah. What are you advising them in terms of their finances at this point? Because they've taken the advice, they made it.
Right.
We're seeing more people with wealth.
Right.
Everybody's not going to buy real estate. So, like, how are you looking at the clients now as they accumulate more wealth than they've ever had before?
Yeah, one of the age-old cliches is that, like, lifestyle creep. Right? Like, people start making more money and they just feel like, I got to get the next car. I got to get the bigger house. And just really trying to embed in my clients, like, what you're really after is you want to buy freedom, right? Like, you don't want more stuff, right? So I help them understand the qualitative side of financial planning, right? Like, where do you want to go? What do you want to do? Who do you want to help? What does life look like? And make sure that the way that they're preserving their money and the way they're allocating it is in alignment to be able to give them more opportunities to do more of that, right? When I first got started in the financial services industry, I heard this, I went to this event and this lady was like, in 2011, 1 billion drill bits were sold, right? And she said, nobody wants a drill bit. She said, let's assume that they use the drill bit to hang up pictures and artwork all across the country. She said nobody really wanted the artwork. What they wanted is the feeling they got when they walked in the room where the artwork was hung. So I really try to help my clients understand, like, what do you want out of life and how can we use your financial resources to do more of that, right? And the other thing I try to do is try to create investing and lifestyle alignment, right? Because, you know, I think early pandemic, everybody was doing Turo and Airbnb. Like, mm-hmm. They were trying to do everything. But, like, you got to really ask yourself, like, is that in alignment with what I want to do? So I really help them figure out, like, what matters to them. And then that influences the investing decision, right? They don't want to do real estate. They don't have to do real estate, right? Maybe they are more—
Because real estate is not passive.
At least not in the beginning.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So maybe they're more heavily invested in the market, right? Maybe they're interested in acquiring a business that they own but do not run. But we let the business and lifestyle alignment kind of drive and dictate what we do, not just, like, what's going to provide the greatest return.
So from a financial planning standpoint, what's the fundamentals as far as building wealth?
So the first thing, in my opinion, is you have to establish, I think you start with an estate plan, because that's the kind of starting with the end in mind, right? It's like, all right, well, what do I want this to ultimately look like? How do I want to preserve this wealth, and how do I want to pass it on, right? Then from there, right, you have a journey until you get to that target. So you're probably going to be in the accumulation phase. You're not going to have all the money right away.
So the estate plan, what will be in the estate plan?
Will be in the estate plan. So you would have a trust, a will, medical directives, right? I was actually talking to a lady on the plane about it, because she's an estate planning attorney. And she was like, one thing that people really forget about and overlook is the medical directives piece, right? Because, like, everybody thinks about what happens when I pass away, but what happens when you're here and you're incapacitated and you need somebody to make decisions on your behalf.
Like a living will.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And so you have that as a part of your estate plan. And then from there, it's like, okay, well, I have this phase or this journey to get to this target. So now I might want to purchase life insurance so that if something happens to me before I accumulate all the wealth, I already have a vehicle that's going to fund the dreams and aspirations that I have for my family. Right. Then from there, I think the next most important thing is cash flow. I don't care how much money you make. Right. If you don't have a great handle on your cash flow, if you're not a good steward over the resources that are flowing into your bank account, right, you're not going to be able to have the resource to allocate towards building wealth. Once you have a strong, solid base on your cash flow, then we can talk about investing and retirement planning because we know how much we can allocate because we've created a cash flow plan. Right. And then other than that, just filling in the gaps on any other risk management, making sure you have your, you know, the right health insurance, disability insurance. And one thing that people don't realize is you're actually three times more likely to become temporarily disabled in your working career than you are to die prematurely, right? So a lot of people overlook disability insurance and making sure that we are protecting you and putting a good moat around your financial plan so that as you're building the wealth, you can make sure that you're watching out for any unforeseen.
Well, so let's break this down a little bit if we can. What's the best life insurance that somebody should get?
Yeah, I think it depends upon your circumstances. I think if you're young and you don't have a lot of cash flow, I think a renewable term policy is great. Yeah. Right? Because now you can still have the coverage and protection, but as you get older, you have the ability to convert that into permanent insurance, right? Because insurance is based off age and health. Mm-hmm. But in the ideal scenario, everybody, in my opinion, would want to have some version of permanent insurance. I think whole life insurance is great. Some people like index universal life. Mm-hmm. But I think having that as a part of your overall strategy is amazing because that's going to create tax-free cash flow available, right, when you pass away. So that as your family is navigating the estate planning conversation, you already have that cash available and don't have to liquidate assets or do anything like that.
And one thing we always talk about is how, like, life insurance is oversold in the Black community.
Yeah. Oversold?
Yeah, over. Well, like, it's overemphasized on social media for people to become their own bank, right, with life insurance. Mm-hmm. And my thing is, like, if you ain't got no money in your own bank, how are you going to spend some time? How are you going to focus on becoming your own bank? So there is a place for whole life insurance. There is a place for permanent insurance, but like that's not an investment. Like there's a couple things you need to do, at least in my opinion, from a financial advising standpoint. There's things you need to have in place before you set up that permanent insurance. That permanent insurance is not your investment account. It's not your IRA. It is a place for you to invest in after you got the basics down packed. One thing I see a lot of people doing, they don't got no money in their savings account. They don't got no money in their investment account. And they're being told to stuff their life insurance policies with money, even though the cash value won't accumulate for 2 to 3 years.
So explain that. Explain, just go into that, because for people that might not have be fully understanding what you're saying.
Yeah.
There's term insurance, which is just regular insurance. Right. It's like car insurance, right? Mm-hmm. You pay it for 10, 15, 20 years. If you die within that time frame, your family gets money. If you don't die,
mm-hmm, then they keep the money.
Right.
Yeah.
But then what you're referring to is like whole life or universal life, where it lasts your whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's money that grows inside the policy.
Exactly.
So infinite banking,
that's the term. Yep.
So that's been popularized online.
Yeah.
Where people say, okay, utilize this life insurance policy as a vehicle to put money in, and then you can borrow money from your life insurance policy on a tax advantage basis. Mm-hmm. As opposed to having it sitting in the bank.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Yep.
So you're saying that that's not necessarily the best way to go about it for the average person, right?
It's not, because I think it's overtaught but underexplained, right? And so if you put, you know, $1,000 a month into this life insurance policy, people think, oh, I can go borrow the money immediately. Mm-hmm. The problem is the insurance company is going to keep that money first. Your cash value is not going to accumulate to about the second year. Mm-hmm. So if you put $24,000 in there, and then you're like, oh, I need some money. And they're like, well, your cash value hasn't accumulated yet. And then now you can't afford to do $1,000 a month anymore. They cancel your policy. The insurance company keeps all the money. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's just, you have to be educated on it, because it can be a good policy, but there's also a way where you can put that same $1,000 a month into an investment account.
Mm-hmm.
And invest the money into stocks or index funds. And then that broker will let you borrow against your investment portfolio, tax deferred, the same way a life insurance policy is. But the thing with this strategy is the money is available immediately. So if I put $1,000 a month into this brokerage account, it's $12,000 a year, I can immediately borrow 50% of it
In your name or in your business name?
In my personal name.
Okay. Yep.
Right. So
it's like margin account. You talking about?
Yeah. If you need to borrow against it, and then you pay the interest back, but that's fine. But now you got all the money that you need, and if you can't pay it back, the brokerage company is going to say, okay, well, we're going to use your investment as collateral. I just think that's another way to go about it, because the money is available to you immediately, mm-hmm. versus you having to wait into 2 years for a life insurance policy. Yeah. I think there's a place for everything. I just want it to be communicated better, mm-hmm. to our people so they can fully understand it, because what they don't understand is that the reason that the person is telling you to do this is because they make more money by you buying a whole life policy than they do if you buy a term policy.
Sure.
So I think there needs to be more transparency around the education of life insurance. It's needed.
For sure.
But it just needs to be talked about a little bit deeper.
This is an important conversation, and also important because you said a lot was just given.
Sorry.
That's a lot. But as you're creating more millionaires, mm-hmm. right, the most important thing is that people, if they have $1 million, doesn't mean that their account is going to save $1 million.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what are some strategies to make sure that people actually retain some of the money they're making? Because we know, depending on what state you live in,
yeah.
taxes are going to cut that at least 40%.
Yep. Right.
So what are some strategies that entrepreneurs can use to make sure, or loopholes that they can use to make sure that they keep as much of the asset as possible?
How much time you got?
Let's do it, man. I'm writing my notes now.
Start with the tax strategy, and then I'll talk about how we advise more investment. Yeah.
1,000%. So let's say you have... $1 million in, let's say you make $1 million in your business. I'm gonna try to help you write off that whole $1 million. So one of the first things you can do is you can set up a retirement plan, like a solo 401k, and that will allow you to put up to $69,000 into your retirement account as a business owner, and then IRS will also give you a $69,000 tax deduction for doing so. Mm-hmm. So you're getting a tax deduction for today for you investing for yourself in the future. Another strategy that we can take advantage of is setting up something called a private family foundation. Now, these are key because it's a foundation that you set up, but you can give the money to your heirs and your family. So we can set up a private family foundation, and we can put up to 30% of our AGI, our income, into this private family foundation. So if I make $1 million in income, I can put $300,000 in my private family foundation, and IRS is going to give me a $300,000 tax deduction.
So now I'm at $370,000 deducted.
Yeah.
So the private family foundation, that's a charity?
Yeah, it's a charity that you set up for you and your family. So you can put this $300,000 in this private family foundation, and you can use it for scholarships for your kids, scholarships for your grandkids to go to college. You don't have to disperse this to anybody else outside of who you want to. So it doesn't have to go to a 501c3. It can go to your family, which makes it so powerful. And you only have to disperse 5% a year. But what's key about this is that disbursement can be paying somebody to manage the private family foundation. Mm-hmm. So you can hire your own family member to run the foundation for you, pay them a salary, and that's all the money you have to distribute per year until you're ready to use the money later. So it's really like you're putting this money into a foundation for your family.
Yeah.
And you don't have to disperse it until you want to. But now your kids and your grandkids have a college fund, and now you don't have to use any of your money for it. So now we have about $370,000.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing I would recommend you do is you purchase a real estate property, because with real estate, we get something called depreciation. And with the proper cost seg study, you are able to write off 30% of the value of the property that you purchase it. So if we purchase a $500,000 property at 30% with the cost seg study, that's another $150,000 write-off that you can get. And you just got an investment property. So now you're cash flowing from the investment property and you're lowering your taxes at the same time. So now we're about $500,000. We can take advantage of buying vehicles for our business, which this year you're able to deduct 60% of the vehicle sticker price if it weighs over 6,000 pounds. So if we buy a Sprinter for our business to take our clients out to lunch or whatever, that's another $60,000 right there. And yeah, there are some more strategies, but I don't want to take up all the time.
Nah, this is good. And you have a nice Sprinter. We saw it in LA.
Yeah, for sure. That was. Yeah. So these are just some like base level strategy. And I think the last thing I would give people, which is very key, is something called the Augusta Rule, which is I don't know why more people aren't talking about it. It's huge. So with the Augusta Rule, you are legally able to rent out your primary home to your business for up to 14 days a year, right? And your business pays you rent. And you don't have to recognize the rental income on your taxes. And if you're smart, you will do this around times that your city is popping. So right now we're in New York and the UN is here. Mm-hmm. So we talk about how hotel rates are $3,000 a night. So if you decided to rent out your home to your business right now, you can look at the rent rates. They're quadruple right now. So now you can charge your business $2,000 a night. Mm-hmm. To rent out your home for 14 days a year, that's $28,000. Your business will get a $28,000 tax deduction, and you will receive that $28,000 tax-free. Like, these are literally strategies the IRS gives us to lower our taxes, but it's on us to learn the strategies of the game so that we can win the game.
Big facts. And then we think about, like, actually how the money's invested, right? When you're invested in a brokerage account or investment account, right? I know, shout out to Ian, like, he has a strategy called two tech, two index, right? And in the financial services industry, right, we have this concept just called core satellite investing, right? But how does that apply? How does that work to somebody who wants to invest and maybe be able to outpace the market a little bit? So the way I articulate it is, like, I call it the Burger King investment strategy, right? So McDonald's spends millions of dollars a year trying to figure out where they want to put the next McDonald's. We all know McDonald's is also in the real estate business. So they're trying to figure out where is the best place to put it. All Burger King does, right, conceptually, is put it in proximity to McDonald's. And the reason why I say that's a great way to approach investing is because it's okay to be a copycat if you copy the right cat.
Talk about
it. When you think about Charles Schwab, TD Ameritrade, they got acquired, Fidelity, right? These big investment institutions, Vanguard, they have analysts and they spend millions and millions of dollars a year trying to figure out, like, what should be going in these funds, right? You go to Vanguard.com, look up VOO, all you got to do is click the buy button, right? And if you just did just that on the first trading day of the year, you're up 21%, right? So that's the first piece, right? It's like, okay, cool. I copied the right cat. But then when I looked inside of what was inside of these funds, right, I look at an index fund just like a mall, right? You go to any popular city, your favorite mall is going to have hundreds of stores, right? And at any given time, some stores are going to be more popular, some stores are going to be less popular, right? But the mall itself is never going to close down, right? So when you buy an index fund or ETF, you get to basically buy that mall. But when you look inside of it, let's say that Apple is one of the stores inside of the mall, right? We know that Apple is probably going to be one of the dominant stores in that particular mall. Same thing with this index fund or ETF. So what I did, I was like, okay, well, what if I had $10,000 to invest? And of the $10,000, maybe $7,000 I'm buying this index fund or this ETF. But with 30% of my portfolio, I'm identifying winners that might have a higher potential to outpace the broader diversified portfolio. Because these index funds have, you know, 500 different companies in them. Obviously, some of them are underperforming. Some of them might eventually get replaced. So how can I identify some ones that might have the ability to outperform the Googles, the NVIDIAs, et cetera, have 30% of my portfolio in, you know, technology companies or companies I believe are going to outpace it. And that's how our clients are able to outpace the market really every year, right? It's a very simple strategy. And so it's kind of similar to what Ian talks about, but all you do is you're looking at a globally diversified ETF or index fund and then identifying what are the companies that have the highest probability to outpace, right, some of the returns. And combining that strategy has allowed our clients to do really well.
So you talked about estate planning with trust and will. So can you explain that a little bit? Because sometimes people get confused on what's the difference between a trust and a will, and do you even need a will, or what's a trust? That's another thing that has been very popularized on social media.
For sure.
Talk about, like, can you just kind of break down the will and trust situation?
Yeah.
Do that, and I'll talk about the difference between revocable and irrevocable trust because it's a tax standpoint.
Yeah, cool. So from a will standpoint, at the end of the day, you simply want to dictate who is going to get what, who's entitled to whatever you want to leave behind when you're no longer here, right? The reason why people like the idea of a trust is because you can have a little more control to determine when and how those assets get disseminated once you're gone, right? Because obviously if you have a will, right, once you're gone, right, it pretty much dies with you, right? But that could be good in certain situations. I don't think everybody necessarily needs a trust. But if you want to ensure that your heirs, maybe at 18, my son has to do this thing before he gets, you know, $15,000 for a down payment on a house or whatever the case may be, the trust can be established in a way to control how that money is disseminated, right? Especially if you have children that are minors and things of that nature, you want to really make sure that they get what they're supposed to get when they are supposed to get it, right? So that's the kind of the fundamental difference between trust and wills. I think what happens is people like the idea of a trust because of the control piece. But at the same token, like, you don't want to overcomplicate your finances, mm-hmm. right? Because sometimes with a trust, like the upkeep, right? If you, you know, if you do too much, like it can be a little bit overwhelming. Like I know my mother-in-law before she met me, she had a very complicated trust and just decided not to do it anymore because it was just too much, right? So making sure that it makes sense relative to your situation. What is it that you actually want to achieve? And then that will determine if I just need a basic will or do I need a trust to make sure that I can pass on my assets in a way that's a little bit more strategic relative to who I'm passing them on to.
Yeah, and I think the difference between a revocable trust and an irrevocable trust is huge, and I don't think enough people know the difference. So a revocable living trust, which I think everybody should have at some point in their life, is like a safe that you have the combination to. You can put assets in there. You can take assets out. It's you can change the assets in there. You can change the beneficiaries. It has a lot of flexibility. And the purpose of a revocable living trust is so that when you pass away, none of your assets go to probate court. Because we saw with Chadwick Boseman, he didn't have a revocable living trust. Mm-hmm. So he lost almost $1 million of his estate to probate court. Because just because you say that your family should get something in their will doesn't mean they're going to agree on it. And the more time they spend arguing in probate court, the more money that the lawyers make and the more money that the court system makes. With the revocable living trust, it says, like, it's stamped saying that all of my assets go to these people. This is how they get it. This is when they get it. So a revocable living trust is huge for avoiding probate court. Another reason that you want to have a revocable living trust is because it helps us with taxes. So here's an example. If I bought a property at $200,000 and that was worth $1 million and I put it in my revocable living trust, when my kids get it, they get something called a step up in basis. So in my example, I have $800,000 in gains. I paid $200,000 for it. Now it's worth $1 million. So it's an $800,000 built-in gain that if I was to give it to them when I was alive, they would have to pay that $800,000 in capital gains taxes. Mm. When we put it in our revocable living trust and I pass away and pass it to my kids, they get what's called a step up in basis. So they receive the property with $1 million fair market value and they can sell it the next day and pay no capital gains taxes. So by putting the property in a revocable living trust, you help your kids avoid unnecessary taxes on assets that you're trying to pass down. And that's how we build true generational wealth. We don't want to just pass down assets. We want to pass down tax-free assets, right, which is very important. And an irrevocable trust is, in my opinion, is only used for estate planning purposes. And unless your estate is over $13 million, you probably don't need an irrevocable living trust because you don't pay estate taxes until your estate reaches that high. So you don't want to put things in an irrevocable trust before that because you can't benefit from it in your lifetime. If you put a property in an irrevocable trust that's worth $1 million and it generates $100,000 a year in cash flow, you can't take that because it's irrevocable. You can't benefit from it. So it's just understanding what people need. And personally, I think most people need a revocable living trust until they reach that $13 million mark.
Yeah, I was reading an article maybe last week about Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah.
And he's in court now because he has an irrevocable trust. Mm-hmm. And I think it's based on succession. He doesn't want to pass it down to this heir.
Yeah.
So like irrevocable. Cannot change.
Lock, it's a safe, throw away the key, put it in the bottom of the ocean.
What about an ILA, right, where it's a life insurance policy inside the trust? Is that a good idea?
It can be. I haven't studied ILAs that much, but I have heard about them. None of our clients have needed it thus far, but I think it can be a powerful policy, but it has to be structured the right way. And it's going to cost a little bit of money to get that set up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were talking about this the other day on.
Is the Chicken Big Mac still a Big Mac? It's got two chicken patties, the pickles, the lettuce, ooh, the cheese, the sesame seed bun, and it's got the sauce. It's not a Big Mac. Get it while you can. At participating McDonald's for a limited time.
88% of the work week is spent communicating, so it's important your team does it well. Enter Grammarly. Grammarly's AI helps teams communicate clearly the first time. It shows you how to make words resonate with your audience, helps with brainstorming, and lets you instantly create and revise drafts in just one click. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who use Grammarly to move work forward. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise Ready AI.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
On Market Mondays, actually, about buying life insurance policies on family members. Mm-hmm. I want thoughts around that in terms of planning, I guess, for the future and also wealth creation, because we've seen this happen in other communities, not so much in ours. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, if we remove emotion from it, right, at the end of the day, we know that our loved ones are going to pass away, right? And if you have, if your desire is to create generational wealth, right, for your family, it's like, hey, let's just have a conversation about it. Like, what does that look like, right? So, for example, if you have a parent that's aging, right, you have life insurance on them. Maybe they didn't have opportunity. They didn't have a Market Mondays. They didn't have Earn Your Leisure. They didn't have Melanin Money. They didn't have opportunity to accumulate a lot of wealth, right? One of the great things about life insurance is that it can close that gap for pennies on a dollar, obviously assuming, you know, you have, are in decent health. So I think it can be a great strategy. Some people even go as far as, you know, having the family trust, right? And then the trust being the beneficiary of the life insurance. And then when you pass away, the money goes into the trust. And then now that can kind of keep the trend going. But I think personally it's a great strategy. I think we're just so emotional about it and we feel like, oh, that's blood money. You waiting on me to die, right? You get life insurance. But if we remove the emotion from it and we're like, yo, like this is what we want our family to look like for generations to come. What is the most efficient way for us to do that? I think life insurance can be a great vehicle to facilitate that.
You spoke about something earlier that we haven't spoken about a lot, disability insurance.
Yeah.
Why, just talk about that. Like, why is that important? And like, what's some details that people should know about disability insurance?
Yeah, so I can speak from personal experience. So when I was 28, I got married and I was having this crazy random back pain. I thought I was like maybe deadlifted too much weight or something. And then come to find out I had a benign tumor in my 9th vertebrae, right? That fractured my spine. I had to relearn how to walk. It was a whole situation, right? Wife had to like lock into the vows very early.
yeah.
60 days, yeah. You know what I'm saying? And people don't realize is that you are 3 times more likely to become temporarily disabled than you are to die prematurely, right? And so what disability insurance does, it's an insurance coverage on your income. Like we have insurance on everything. We have insurance on our cell phones. We do have, some of us have insurance on our lives, but what's the insurance if you get hurt or sick and can't work? What's the insurance on that, right? Yeah. And so disability insurance bridges that gap. Sometimes if you're employed, you might have insurance and it might cover 50 to 60%, right? But that's also gonna be a taxable benefit. So I always ask people, if I cut your check in half right now, could you live off 50 or 60% of your income? They're probably like, no, I can't, right? And so having disability insurance and or supplemental disability insurance can kind of close that gap so that if you get hurt or you get sick, you have the ability to still meet your needs because you can't call American Express. You can't call the mortgage company and say, hey, I can't work right now. Can I defer these bills? They're going to say, ain't nothing we can do for you, right? So disability insurance bridges that gap to ensure that if anything happens to you, you're okay. Now, some of the features and benefits of disability insurance that you want to think about are like there are certain policy benefits that they call riders, right? And basically the way they work is like, for example, let's say that you are a surgeon. Mm-hmm. Right? And you make your money with your hands, right? So what you would probably want to do is you want to get special provisions in the disability policy to ensure that, hey, look, I can still go be a professor, right, and teach what I do, but because I can't use my hands, right, I need to be able to still receive income because that was my primary source of income. Because with disability insurance, it does create a little bit of a moral hazard. The reason why they don't like let you get 90% is like, well, shoot, you know, people gonna game the system and like, I'm not gonna work.
Make an injury.
Right. So you just gotta be mindful of the riders and the clauses that allow you to take advantage of it. Like if you have like a special skill set, to be able to still benefit from it, but potentially still earn income in other ways, like, you know, being a teacher or a professor, that's even if
own,
you can't.
Own occupation?
That's yes.
Rider?
Yes.
Still got it, man. Yeah, hey, you still got it, brother.
Still got it.
Yeah. Y'all's active out here, y'all.
Bring it. Yeah.
Back. Get it through underwriting. Yo, I need that.
Yeah.
I don't know about that.
Yeah.
But, as business partners, yeah. Right? What about having insurance on each other, right? Or buy-sell agreements. People don't talk about that.
Yeah.
But if something happens to Carter,
yep.
You know, what happens to the business? Yeah. What happens to the income?
Yeah.
These things need to be discussed.
That's 100% true. Yeah,
let's talk about it.
We're talking with our lawyers about that in the making right now. Because, and like one thing I love about our relationship, we have the tough conversations on the front end.
Yeah.
Like, bro, like if you do something crazy or you're not around, like love is cool, but everything needs to be in writing. So we are working with our lawyers on our buy-sell agreements and things like that because it's so important. because we want this business to be generational. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to lose it just one generation with us. So we are putting those things in place literally as we speak to make sure we protect our business and protect ourselves.
Yeah, and from a bot, just for the benefit of the listeners, like when it comes to a buy-sell agreement, the reason why you want to have that is because let's say something does happen to me, right? Like if I own 50% of the business, right? And technically that, you know, my wife inherits that. My wife is great, but I don't think she's like, like, yo, all right, so like, I'm gonna start managing these portfolios.
Yeah, the same thing.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? She might not be the best person to do that, right? So, and one thing you can also do is you can get buy-sell agreements funded with life insurance, right? So that way it's like, all right, well, something happens to you, right? My wife, I mean, I would trust and believe that something happened to my wife would be good. Regardless.
Yeah, you'd be good, brother. I got you, man. Right?
Paper, it's been documented.
Right, documented. It's on record.
Yeah.
But being able to say, okay, cool, the buy-sell agreement is funded by life insurance. Something happens to you that I buy you out and then your wife gets those proceeds, right? So, but it's important, right? Like from day one, when we formally locked in, like we made sure that everything was solidified, all the documentation was squared away because I had started the brand first. I said, I think it's time for us to, you know, go further with this. He's like, bet, let's do it. I was like, okay, cool.
And then,
send us some paperwork, right?
Yeah.
But we did it on the front end so we could just, documentation beats conversation. But those things have to be in place if you want to make sure that your business is solidified.
Yeah. And I think business structure is really important as well.
Yeah.
I don't think enough people talk about because the way our business is structured, we could have just been a traditional partnership, which is fine. But there are some tax limitations by having a traditional partnership because if he wants to go to a conference and deduct the expense on our taxes, I'm like, well, I don't want to go to that conference. I don't want the business to have to pay for that, mm-hmm. right? And so if you have a traditional partnership and you and your partner are not agreeing on a specific deduction, then you can't take it, right? So the way we set it up is that we have our LLC, which is our Melanin Money, and then we have our S Corps, 50% owner of that company. So now I can take all the deductions I want to take in my S Corp. He can take all the deductions that he wants in his S Corp, and we only take group business deductions in our LLC for Melanin Money. And, you know, I see a lot of new partnership business owners lose out on tens of thousands of dollars in deductions because their financial structure is not the way it should be to maximize their tax savings.
Mm-hmm. What about, all right, so a big thing is people that want to plan for their kids.
Yeah.
Whether it's college savings,
yep.
whether it's when they put life insurance on their kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a variety of different ways that people can save money for their kids, right?
Yep.
So if somebody's coming to your office mm-hmm. and they just got married and they have a baby on the way, right? Talk through the process that you would educate them as far as the different ways that they can actually set their children up.
100%. I mean, like you said, there's a lot of ways. Because they'll be just a newborn baby, right? We probably wouldn't start entertaining the conversation of putting them on payroll, right?
Yeah. I'll talk about newborn, then I'll come on the back end and talk about that part.
that might be an audit red flag.
Yeah.
But I think one of the ways is you can always obviously set up a custodial accounts in the beginning. What that means is, right, is kind of joint ownership. You can control it until the kid reaches a certain age. And so deciding what you want to do for the kid. So do you want the kid to go to college, right? Do you want to say, want them to be able to buy their first property at a certain age? I like to start with the end in mind, with the target. And then from there, we can figure out the best investment vehicles or the best options. So one of the things would definitely be opening up a custodial brokerage account. Another thing would be also getting a life insurance policy on them as well, because insurance is based off age and health. And when you do design it the right way, there are ways where you can have something called high early cash value, or you can have 10 pays or 20 pays. And while your commission as an agent, if you get compensated that way, goes down, that is the best thing for the client, right? So those are two fundamental things that I would do, because I mean, at that age, right, being able to get a policy and getting a custodial account, and people don't realize the number one thing in investing that you have to your advantage is time, right? So being able to get that started, you know, literally from day one is a super advantage for sure.
What about 529?
I'm not against 529s. I mean, there's some tax benefits from it.
Yeah. They just became sexy again.
Yeah, they did.
Because you can convert them to a Roth IRA now.
Yeah, so I'm not against. I think 529s are great vehicles. I just like to optimize for flexibility.
Yeah.
I think that we just live in a very different environment. I think when I was in school, when I was in college, you know, you would hear things like, oh, that's not a profession, that's not a career. And people might not be going to college in the same way that they are now with the advent of certain technology. But I'm not against them. I think they could be
So you could turn to a
Yeah. So
well, because I want to just custodial before you jump.
Yeah.
Utma. preferential, or because like you said, you're thinking of the end in mind.
Yeah.
And there's different levels of control you can have, right? At 18.
Yeah.
Control's over.
Yeah.
So what's your
stance? I think if you're passing down the methodology, right? That's a big, we didn't talk a lot about it, right? But like a big part of all of this is as you're setting this stuff up, like you don't want to just do what you didn't have for your kids. You want to educate them so they have the methodology and the mindset on why you did it. Mm. Right. And so for me, I think even though you're giving up control at 18, if you did what you were supposed to do in terms of like advising them at every step, especially once you're able to put them on payroll, hey, this is why we're doing it. This is what we're going to use the money for. I could have just given you the money, but the reason why we're putting you on payroll, which I'll let you expound upon, mm-hmm. the reason why we're putting you on payroll is because this is what it means for our business. And this is tax-free income to you. And now we can invest it into the Roth IRA, not to steal your thunder.
But leave something on the bone for me, bro. Right.
So I think it's about the education, right? I mean, control is control. It's great. But at the end of the day, like I was mentioning, I was talking to this lady on the plane who has adult children, and she was just like, your kids are going to be your kids. You can only do
so much,
right? And in my opinion, you know, within the first 18 years of life, if you did what you're supposed to do, they're going to take what they're supposed to take, and they're going to do what they want to do. So I'm personally, I don't need control, at least me personally, beyond the age of 18.
Yeah. And one of my favorite strategies that I don't think enough people utilize is hiring their kids into their business. What most people do is they make money, they pay taxes on that money, and then they pay their kids, which is okay. It's a good start, but I think it's a better way to do it. You make money first, then you hire your kids into your business. And when you do this, you're able to pay each of your kids, I'm sure y'all heard this before, mm-hmm. up to $14,600 each per child. And your business receives the $14,000 tax deduction as if you pay anybody else. And your kids can receive this $14,600 tax-free because the standard deduction wipes out their income. They don't have to file a tax return. You don't have to send them a 1099. You don't have to send them a W-2. None of that. They get that $14,000 tax-free. And then if I were you, I would take $7,000 of that $14,000 and put it into a Roth IRA for them because they probably don't need all the money right now. And if you do this from when your kids are age, I recommend you can start hiring your kids in your business after age 7, because that's when they can actually do work, you know, answer the phones, clean up the office, stuff like that. If you do this from when your kids are age 7 to when your kids are age 17, that's the cutoff for hiring your kids into your business, they will have about $130,000, $140,000 of tax-free money in their Roth IRA. Not to mention, they've been learning from you as a boss for the last 10 years. So not only are you teaching them, are you paying them for their work, but you're teaching them entrepreneurial skills at the same time. So I think this is a great way to save money on taxes in your business, pass down tax-free wealth to your kids, and help them get a head start on entrepreneurship at the same time. And I think that more people should take advantage of, you know, hiring their kids in their business and giving them the ropes.
Super valuable. At 17, they're probably going to make the biggest financial decision mm-hmm. other than buying a house, which is, yep. am I going to school?
Yeah, and now you got your own money to make that decision.
True.
Yeah. Now, because like, you can go to school on my dime for $100,000, but no, you got $120,000. You can use that for college, or what I plan to do for my kids, I would say like, this is the seed capital you need for your business. We don't need to go find outside funding or find investors. You have $100,000 to put towards that business idea. I'll be the CFO of the company. I'll help you deploy the money into your business. But I want my kids to have options on what they want to do instead of having to take the traditional route.
Well, so what's the conversion that you can 529 to a Roth?
Oh, yeah. So with the 529 plan, the problem that I used to have with it is that money needs to be used for college or you have to pay taxes on the earnings from that money. And let's face it, you know, 18 years from now, like college might be less of a thing than it already is today. Mm-hmm. And so if they don't want to go to college, then you have to now pay taxes on that money. But the rule is today you can convert, I believe it's up to $36,000 of 529 money into a Roth IRA and not have to pay any taxes on there. So like if your kids are 18, say, hey, I don't want to go to college, you can convert that money to a Roth IRA and it can continue to grow tax-free, which is a huge flexibility option for kids now. So now 529 plan is like, hey, if you don't want to go to college, I can either change the name to another child or I can convert it to a Roth IRA and they can continue growing tax-free forever. Hmm. Which is pretty big.
Yeah, and so this is, I mean, amazing information. One of the things that people always ask us about is asset allocation. Mm-hmm. Right. And so in order to do these things, to have these strategies, they have to know how to spend, how to save, where they put. So what is the recommended percentages I guess case to case, but just an overarching theme of what asset allocation would look like.
Yeah, even cash flow, personal finance. So, I mean, just to your point, depending on how much money you make, I don't think you need to be paying yourself 50% of that for general expenses. Yeah. But the average person, I would say, let's keep your necessities, right? Your housing, your cars, all that stuff, bills, utilities. But ideally around 50, but no more than 60%, right? Like between that 50 to 60% range is pretty decent. Then 15 to 20% of your money for like your wants, right? Being able to travel, dining out, entertainment, like those things that could be very variable, right? And then another 15 to 20% for allocated for investing. Now, as your income increases, right, we want those percentages to flip, right? So for example, like, you know, they say the average retirement age is 65, but when you really do the math, the reason why the average retirement age is 65 is because the average person makes $50,000 in the United States, right? Meaning they did everything right. They can maybe allocate 10% towards investing and saving, which means that's going to take them 30 plus years to accumulate $1 million nest egg. But if you make $100,000, you've doubled your income. And if you just doubled your savings rate from 10% to 20%, now you can put away four times more money, right? So I think one of the keys is as your income increases, strategically increasing your savings rate. Because here's the thing, even if your lifestyle does increase as you make more money, as long as you've increased your savings rate, you're always guaranteeing and baking in the fact that I'm now going to increase my investing as well. But to start out, I think those are great percentages. But as your income increases, I think, you know, anything above six figures, I would try to get that. I would try to get those necessities down to like closer to 50%, maybe even less, and then continue to increase the saving and investing allocation so that you can just get to your target faster. Because retirement has nothing to do with age. It has everything to do with assets. It's a number. You don't have to be 65, right? It's like, oh, I got a target. Now this is the number. How can I get there as fast as possible? You get there as fast as possible by being a good steward over your finances.
Yeah. How do we get tricked into thinking that 65 is like, now I want to do whatever I want to do in life? Like, you know, like my knees barely work. Like so we always tell our clients, like, retirement is not an age. It is a number. The faster we get you there, the faster you can, like, do whatever you want. So it's about more, you know, financial freedom than it is about retirement, because it's just like, at what point do I have enough money when my investments can pay me out to live my lifestyle? And at that number, if you want to stop working, stop working. But I just think that we as a people, as a culture, need to get away from that 65 and now I can live my life. Life is meant to do more than that.
Thanks. So what's the process? Somebody comes into your office.
Yep.
You guys in Atlanta, right?
Nah, actually, we used to do a lot of stuff in Atlanta, but now I'm actually based in Charlotte, North Carolina, and we're both moving to Dallas actually next month.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So the office is going to be in Dallas,
So it's going to be in Dallas?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, we're just in Dallas.
Yeah. Or,
okay, y'all come back often. Yeah, we're going to be there. We're going to Atlanta City for y'all. Yeah.
Hospitality.
And you still in Chicago right now?
No, I actually been living in Medellin for like a year and a half, Columbia.
Columbia?
Yeah.
Where do you think that was going?
Yeah.
How's that coming?
What state is that?
So the first question I get is it for tax purposes? And the answer is no, because the U.S. is on a U.S.-based tax system. So as long as on a resident-based tax system, so as long as you are a U.S. resident, you pay U.S. taxes, unless you live in Puerto Rico, and that's a different conversation. But dude, I just want to get good at Spanish and learn how to dance salsa. So I wish I had a better answer.
How often do you stay out there?
Well, I've been living out there for about a year and a half.
Like you do like months at a time?
And I'll come back for events and things like that, client events like that. But we're planting our flag in Dallas because, you know, if we built this business this big from two different states, two different countries, imagine how far we can grow it living in the same city.
So if somebody's working with you guys now, how does that, is virtual?
For the most part, yeah.
Virtual,
yeah,
like a Zoom meeting. Mm-hmm. And then you do everything. It's not like a lot of in-person stuff.
No, nah, we have three in-person events a year, and we do like regional meetups like we did one actually last night. But yeah, we have three in-person events a year, client fulfillment events, to give us opportunity to connect. But like, it kind of was a happy accident. Like before COVID even happened, I still have an office, but I don't really use it. I just said I wanted to be able to do stuff virtually. I want to serve clients all across the country. And so we went virtual. And so like, we don't have people just, you know, walk in our office, you know, anymore from that vantage point. All the, you know, intake calls is virtual. All of the, you know, servicing calls are virtual. And then we do meet in person periodically when we do in-person experiences. Yeah.
What's Wealth Weekend?
Wealth Weekend. Wealth Weekend is our anchor. It's our flagship event. And basically it's a, an event that's kind of three parts. So one, the first day is a conference, right? Educational conference. You know, we have a bunch of heavy hitter speakers. Hopefully we can get y'all there next year.
Yeah. Where's it at?
In Atlanta. Maybe we'll move to Dallas at some point, but you know, it'll probably be in Atlanta for
the same reason y'all have Invest Fest in Atlanta every year. Yeah, it's just easier that way.
Just find the right cat to copy, man.
Exactly.
For sure. So it starts out with an educational conference. And then we have a mixer that evening, right? So after, you know, you learn a bunch of stuff, get a chance to like connect with other people. We have a mixer that evening. Then the next day we have a philanthropic event that morning. We didn't talk much about it, but we do have a foundation as well, the Melanin Money Foundation. That foundation's mission is to help 100,000 people achieve economic stability, right? Because you can't think about building wealth if you can't eat, right? Mm-hmm. So there we really are just supporting a lot of other causes that are already doing great work. So whatever city we're in, we have our director find an opportunity for us to do something. This past year or this in July, we did a back to school drive. We stuffed like 250 book bags with supplies, all that jazz. So we do a philanthropy event Saturday morning. Saturday night, we have our award show. And then we have a sneaker ball after party after the
award show. I said I saw the sneaker ball.
Oh, yeah, man. It was great.
I got to represent for the sneaker ball.
Yeah.
And you got some heat.
Yeah.
And Sunday, we do a brunch kind of invite-only situation. We can just kind of connect with our peers.
Yeah. Dude, I mean, it looked incredible. This is the second year?
This was the second year.
It looked incredible. Obviously, Mike was up there. Shout out to Mike on our
with that all white suit.
Yeah.
Come looking better than us at our own event.
Yeah.
It looked incredible. And like I said, when you watch it, just from our viewpoint, it was like, man, this is spectacular. Yeah. This is dope. This is something that it gives people purpose. It's like, yeah, we're getting celebrated for doing something that has nothing to do with entertainment, has nothing to do with sports, has all to do with business, and that's unique. So congratulations on that. I want to talk about My Health Wealth.
Okay.
Right, the website itself, because like I said, people are being transparent on the front end.
Yep.
Are you finding that the clients are becoming more accountable and holding each other accountable in this process as well?
Yeah, because I think now, because the thing is, they now know. They have a measuring stick, right? You can't hit a target you can't see. So the purpose of the wealth health assessment is like, same way if you go into a doctor's office, you wouldn't want the doctor to start prescribing you medication if they didn't know what was going on with you, right? So instead of just saying, you should do this tax strategy, you should invest in this account, you should do this, we have an assessment that covers, I would say, a pretty broad spectrum of the things that at least everybody should have addressed at some point in their financial journey, right? And we quantify that with a score and we see, okay, well, this person doesn't have an estate plan. They don't have disability insurance. They do have a retirement account. They don't have a Roth. We're able to like ask enough questions to figure out where you are. So that way we know not only where to prioritize our focus and how to help you, but you have awareness on what the gaps are. Mm. And you become educated. Like, oh, these are the things I should even be thinking about, right? And then I don't know what it is about human nature, but people just like to gamify things, right? So it's like, my score was a 64. Like, I want to improve that score. So now they're like, no, what's the first thing I can do to improve my score? And they're seeing, you know, tactical things that they can do. And to your point, from a community standpoint, like, they're connecting with each other. Even at our meetup last night, this dude was like, I want to get in real estate. He's like, I'm about to buy a multifamily over here. Just hit me up. They exchange contact information. And now the community, right, is also helping each other. Because if you're valuable to your business, then your business is not valuable, right? What I mean by that is, it's great to be the face. It's great to be online. It's great for people to know who you are. But I'm sure that at some point, you know, Charles Schwab was working at Charles Schwab, but now you can't talk to Charles, right? And it's not to say that Charles is untouchable. It's to say that Charles built a business that can sustain without him, right? I'm pretty sure y'all want the EYL name to live on, whether y'all are behind the mics or not, right? And so we're just trying to do the same thing. And I think that starts with galvanizing the people to empower them, but also, you know, giving them quantifiable ways to know, like, all right, this is what success looks like. It's a clear path. It's a recipe. Whether it's coming from George or Carter, whoever, I have a blueprint on what I need to do, what I need to implement.
Yeah, I think one of the dopest things that we notice at our client events is people are bragging about their financial decisions. It's like, do I max out my Roth IRA already? Or I did that tax strategy, and do I save $100,000 in taxes? And for the first time in my life, people are openly talking about their financial milestones, their financial decisions, their financial wins, which I think the reason why financial literacy is so taboo in the Black culture is, in my opinion, due to embarrassment of what they don't know. So we weren't allowed to talk about finances at my dinner table. Not that it was a bad thing. My parents didn't know, so it made them ashamed, and they were ashamed, so they didn't want us to talk about it. But now we have our client events, and we have our client dinners. Like, people are openly talking about their financial milestones, openly talking about their financial wins, because they're educated, and there's no shame around not knowing about money. And I think if we, the more we educate and the more we implement, we all love talking about stuff that we're good at.
Right.
And then, the better we get with our money, the more we want to talk about it. And the more we talk about it, the more we win as a culture, and the more we win as a community. So that's probably one of the things I love about, you know, our community the most, is that people are bragging about their financial wins, mm-hmm. and it's not taboo anymore. And that helps them get to the next level faster.
Facts.
So, like, who's the ideal client for you guys?
The ideal client is somebody who is an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. who's figured out the money making part, right?
It's like, how much money should they be making?
I would say no less than 100,000. Yeah. And we got something for people who make less than 100,000 as well, but which we can talk about. But no less than, you know, at least your first six figures, because then you got enough clay to mold, right? You got some you know, opportunities and strategies you can take advantage of. But they've by and large figured out the money making part. Sure, do they want to make more? Cool. There's enough coaches and people online talking about ways to make money. We don't need to fill that void, right? But somebody who's an entrepreneur making at least six figures, and has the desire to be an investor, right? Because I think what we've seen as a gap is that people focus so much on the revenue, the top line revenue. They're not paying attention to the bottom line.
Is not equal bottom line, brother.
They're not paying attention to, like, how do I take chips off the table as the owner of this business to make sure I'm prioritizing my personal wealth? Because at the end of the day, if this is set up the right way, I'm an employee of the business that I own, right? So people who are ready to have somebody help them build their personal wealth, right, while they are building their business.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dope, man. You guys know a lot, man. Informative.
This is one of them ones, man.
Yeah.
What's the name of the firm?
Yes. So Capital Wise is the formal name of the firm, right, that we established. But we have a very unique hybrid structure where it's like a mastermind and the firm powers the implementation of the mastermind, right? So we really don't have to talk about the firm anymore that much, because Melanin Money Enterprises is our main entity. Mm-hmm. And then when people come into the ecosystem of Melanin Money, we have this hybrid setup to where, that's how we can serve so many clients, where they can show up for advisor Q&As, where our CFPs are answering their questions in real time on a weekly basis. They can schedule calls with their advisors, but they can also still learn. Because at the end of the day, do we want to keep our clients forever for the foreseeable future? Of course we do. But we also want to educate and empower people as well. And so the mastermind component was important for us to continue to provide people education and resources and different ways to expand their business along with expanding their wealth, right? But Capital Wise is the firm that implements all of the, you know, financial planning, asset management, all that jazz. And that powers our Melanin Money Enterprises.
And Brooks Alliance helps us with the tax planning piece. Or shout out to Shaquana, Shaquana Brooks on that. So we want to create an environment where our clients can still get educated and our clients can get the implementation of the education as well. Yeah. So that, you know, it's a one-stop shop for pretty much everything. Yeah. And I don't know if y'all okay with this, but, like, we want to give your audience a free MyWealth health assessment if they want to take advantage of it.
I saw that in the notes,
man. You know what I'm saying? Just to give the earner something. Because we understand that, you know, you all really, really educate your audience on how to get to the next step financially. And we would love to show them where the gaps are and then some ways that they can improve on their journey to financial freedom.
Yeah, essentially what we're building now was like a fractional family office, right? Like, our goal is to have all the pieces in place so that when it comes to, if you need a real estate advisor, if you're at a point where you're ready to exit your business, you need a business advisor for that. Like, we want to have all those pieces in place. And we have the referral partners for those people right now, but we want to make it more embedded so that whether you're starting, growing, or scaling, we can see you all the way through that client journey. So that we can serve you at every level. And that's why we call our clients rich relatives, because it's like we're trying to build a family office. But but yeah, I mean, because these are things that just, like, our culture doesn't get exposed to. Like, you got to have, you know, $50 million to, like, mm-hmm. have a conversation to entertain working with a family office. But at the end of the day, all it really means is you have a money team, right, that's cohesive, that's coordinated, that can help you make decisions without you having to wonder, like, is everybody operating in your best interest? And that's our ultimate goal, is to build into a fractional family office.
Yeah, I think that's even an educational piece right there. Like, even for some people, prior to maybe the past few years, understanding what a family office is. You want to just break that down? Because some people literally will say,
yeah,
that's so where my family works.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
This is something different.
Yeah. It's like, literally, you hire a financial team and they're on, like, you're their only client, right? Yeah. In a traditional family office standpoint, right? And that means you have your attorneys, business attorneys, you have your family attorney, you have your investment advisor, your financial planner, your tax planner, tax attorney. And their only job is to maximize and preserve
your wealth,
right? That's their only job. They don't have any other clients, right? And so the model is genius, mm-hmm. right? But it's just like the way it's set up now is like, if you don't got 25 million, it's nothing for us to do because you're the only clients, right? So setting up the ecosystem where you can still have the team that's coordinating all that for you, but you don't have to have that much money, I think is a great asset. And that's what we're, aiming to build.
Yeah. And you want to have a financial team because, like, I think a lot of people think it's their job to know all this. Like, it's your job to know about the accounting. It's your job to know about the investing. You should have a team of people that are communicating on your behalf. Mm-hmm. So, like, do what you're best at. Go make money for the business. And you have this team, the financial team on the back end that's helping you preserve the wealth, help you minimize taxes, help you build generation of wealth and all those things. So that's what we're noticing with our clients. They're actually able to grow their business faster because they know that we're taking care of everything on the back end from an investing and tax strategy standpoint.
And they just have the clarity and the confidence, right? Because it's like if you have a bunch of tabs open on your phone or your computer, like, it's inherently going to run slower, right? And a lot of our clients, they have all these things, this unfinished business in the back of their head. Like, I probably do need to redo that tax return from last year. Or I haven't filed taxes. Or I haven't done this. I haven't done that. And they don't realize how that impacts their clarity as a business owner to really run and thrive because all that stuff is just running in the background. So when we come in with our team and say, hey, look, let's get this stuff in good order so you can operate in excellence and not have that stuff in the back of your mind, what we've seen is a lot of people are able to run even faster as entrepreneurs because they finally check those boxes.
That's fine, man. So how can people find you guys? What's the website, all the information?
Yeah, so Melanin Money on all platforms, YouTube, Instagram. Of course, you can follow us individually. I'm George Atchampong Jr. You might want to put that in the show notes under my last name.
Yeah. And for me, it's Cofield_advisor on Instagram, but Melanin Money on all other social media platforms. And I think one of the best ways to tap in with us is to take advantage of the free My Wealth Health Assessment. So again, we can see where you are financially and we can give you recommendations on how to improve that score and what you need to do next. Because again, a lot of people, one of my favorite quotes is that you cannot teach what you do not know and you cannot lead where you did not go. So you can't teach your kids about generational wealth if you haven't gotten there yet. You can't teach about your kids about financial freedom if you haven't learned the financial literacy strategies to get there. So I think the more that we're educated and the more that people are educated, the further they'll go. And that's our goal with, letting everybody take this assessment so they can know where they're going on their journey.
Big facts.
We appreciate you, brothers.
Have it, man. Thank you, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for having us.
Back to Colombia, I'm sure.
Yeah.
There's a plane that we need to cut.
Yeah. that's
a single man's game.
Yeah.
I got to stay stateside.
Oh, man. All right, God. Thank you for rocking us. We'll see you next week. Peace.
Peace.
Is the Chicken Big Mac still a Big Mac? It's got two chicken patties, the pickles, the lettuce, ooh, the cheese, the sesame seed bun, and it's got the sauce. It's not a Big Mac. Get it while you can. And participate in McDonald's for a limited time.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.